Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Behind the Knife is proud to announce our latest collaboration with the Creogs Over Coffee OBGYN podcast to offer the Behind the Knife and Creogs Over Coffee OBGYN Oral Board Review. This course includes 98 high-yield OBGYN scenarios designed to help surgeons ace their oral boards. Just like our other oral board courses, each scenario includes two parts. The first part is a perfectly executed scenario. If you're able to achieve this level of performance in your preparation, you are sure to pass the oral exam with flying colors. The second part introduces high-yield commentary to each scenario. This commentary includes tips and tricks to help you dominate the most challenging scenarios. And now, you can experience the pressure of the real exam with our new Oral Board Simulator. Our AI-powered Oral Board Simulator provides on-demand mock oral exams with personalized feedback and coaching. So please enjoy this sample scenario from the course, which is relevant to general surgeons as well as OBGYN surgeons. And be sure to let your OBGYN colleagues know about this new awesome resource, which can be found along with our other premium offerings at behindtheknife.org. Thanks for listening, and as always, dominate the day.
Behind the Knife Premium.
Today's topic is intraoperative and postoperative wound complications. Written by Marima Ruhotina and recorded by Mary and Faye. All right, so this is a 39-year-old woman who is postoperative day 5 after an abdominal myomectomy via a midline vertical incision. She presents to you with incisional pain, erythema, and serosanguinous drainage, and you are the postoperative provider. How would you start by evaluating this patient?
First, I would obtain a focused history assessing for fever, drainage characteristics, and worsening pain. On physical exam, I'd be inspecting for erythema, tenderness, drainage, or separation along the incisional line, and I would palpate gently for fluctuance or subcutaneous crepitus. If findings are equivocal, I'd maybe consider using an ultrasound to assess for seroma, hematoma, or potential abscess formation.
So on your exam of the incision, you see localized erythema and a small amount of purulent drainage at the level of the skin. What is your next step in management?
For a patient who is coming in with erythema and some small purulent drainage, I would consider opening the superficial portion of the wound under sterile conditions for drainage. I would irrigate it with saline and initiate local wound care with moist dressings. I would also consider starting systemic antibiotics if there was surrounding cellulitis or if the patient had presented with a fever.
So how would you differentiate between a superficial versus a deep wound infection?
When I think about the difference between superficial and deep wound infections, I think about superficial infections only involving the skin and subcutaneous layer of tissue and present with more localized redness and mild drainage. When I think about deeper infections that involve potentially the fascia or muscle, often those might present with fever, significant pain or induration, and they may require more wound exploration to confirm fascial integrity.
After drainage, the fascia appears intact and the granulation tissue begins forming. How would you manage the wound now?
For this patient with a superficial SSI, I would continue with the moist to dry dressing changes to support healing by secondary intention. Once the wound bed is clean and granulating, negative pressure wound therapy may be applied to promote closure and reduce fluid accumulation.
All right, so let's say the patient's wound suddenly drains a very large amount of serosanguinous fluid on postoperative day 8, and you suspect a fascial dehiscence. How would you proceed?
I would take this very seriously, and I would cover the wound with sterile saline-soaked gauze, keep the patient NPO, and take her urgently to the operating room for wound exploration and potential fascial reclosure using a mass closure technique.
So what would be the main risk factors that would predispose a patient to wound complications after an abdominal myomectomy?
When I think about risk factors for wound complications, I usually think about There are some patient factors and there are some surgical factors. For patient factors, I think about a patient's obesity, diabetes status, smoking, anemia, and poor nutrition. For surgical factors, I think about prolonged operative time, hematoma formation, tension at closure, or potentially inappropriate suture selection or technique.
So what are some of the principles that you use to guide optimal fascial closure to hopefully prevent dehiscence in future cases?
When I'm thinking about closing the fascia, I think about doing a potential continuous mass closure for midline vertical incisions with a delayed absorbable monofilament suture, like PDS, as mentioned prior, taking 1 centimeter bites at every 1 centimeter along the incision, maintaining that ratio of 4 to 1 of the suture length to the wound length ratio. I'd ensure proper tension without strangulation of the tissue and close the subcutaneous layer if fat depth exceeds 2 centimeters.
So what measures can be used to reduce surgical site infections in future abdominal procedures?
When I think about ways to reduce surgical site infections in the future, I'd ensure preoperative antibiotic prophylaxis is given within 60 minutes prior to the incision. I would maintain normothermia. I would minimize electrocautery. I'd practice meticulous hemostasis and gentle tissue handling, as all of these can contribute to increased risk for SSI in the future. And then postoperatively, I'd encourage the patient to do early ambulation and ensure maintenance of good glycemic control.
All right, so let's say in this case your patient is obese and has a BMI of 38. How would this affect your management?
When I think about this particular patient, I know that obesity increases the risk of wound infection and potential dehiscence of that fascial layer. I would be vigilant for seroma formation for these patients. And if there was a wound complication, I would be thinking about allowing that wound to heal with secondary intention.
So let's say a seroma forms postoperatively. How would you manage it?
If a seroma forms for this patient, I would think about several things. So if there is a small asymptomatic seroma, I could just observe this and I do not have to intervene. If there is a large or symptomatic seroma, I may aspirate under sterile conditions and apply compression to the area. If I have recurrent seromas, I may need to require, opening the incision, potentially thinking about a drain placement or a capsule excision.
What if this patient was elderly or malnourished and they were undergoing abdominal surgery? What special considerations would you give this population?
In the preoperative space, I would really emphasize preoperative nutritional optimization. And then in the postoperative phase, I would really emphasize early feeding. I would have a heightened sense of monitoring of the wound for these particular patients. I'd also use non-opioid multimodal pain management and early mobilization to enhance their recovery.
What other preventative measures would you apply in future myomectomy cases?
In my future myomectomy cases, I would consider the following: a continuous strict sterile technique throughout the surgery, perioperative antibiotic use, maintenance of normothermia throughout the surgery, ensuring tight glucose control. While I am operating, I want to ensure meticulous hemostasis. Again, I would use that proper fascial closure technique and the appropriate suture material. I would avoid excess electrosurgery. And if that subcutaneous space was greater than 2 centimeters, I would ensure subcutaneous closure. In particular, think about my patient risk factors, including potential patients with higher BMI.
Be sure to listen to Part B for high-yield commentary and other tips and tricks.
Behind the Knife Premium.
Today's topic is intraoperative and postoperative wound complications. Written by Marima Ruhotina and recorded by Mary and Faye. All right, so this is a 39-year-old woman who is postoperative day 5 after an abdominal myomectomy via a midline vertical incision. She presents to you with incisional pain, erythema, and serosanguinous drainage, and you are the postoperative provider. How would you start by evaluating this patient?
First, I would obtain a focus history assessing for fever, drainage characteristics, and worsening pain. On physical exam, I'd be inspecting for erythema, tenderness, drainage, or separation along the incisional line, and I would palpate gently for fluctuance or subcutaneous crepitus. If findings are equivocal, I'd maybe consider using an ultrasound to assess for seroma, hematoma, or potential abscess formation.
Most wound complications occur within the first postoperative week. Hematoma or seroma formation increases infection risk by providing a bacterial medium. Superficial surgical site infections, or SSIs, involve only skin and subcutaneous tissue, while deep incisional infections involve fascia or muscle. Ultrasound or CT can help confirm fluid collections or deeper involvement, especially in obese patients or when exam findings are unclear. So on your exam of the incision, you see localized erythema and a small amount of purulent drainage at the level of the skin. What is your next step in management?
For a patient who is coming in with erythema and some small purulent drainage, I would consider opening the superficial portion of the wound under sterile conditions for drainage. I would irrigate it with saline and initiate local wound care with moist dressings. I would also consider starting systemic antibiotics if there was surrounding cellulitis or if the patient had presented with a fever.
Superficial SSIs are diagnosed clinically and treated with incision and drainage, followed by local wound care. Saline irrigation is preferred, antiseptics such as hydrogen peroxide or povidone iodine delay epithelialization. Systemic antibiotics are reserved for patients with systemic symptoms or extensive cellulitis. Frequent dressing changes maintain a moist, healing environment and promote granulation tissue formation. So how would you differentiate between a superficial versus a deep wound infection?
When I think about the difference between superficial and deep wound infections, I think about superficial infections only involving the skin and subcutaneous layer of tissue and present with more localized redness and mild drainage. When I think about deeper infections that involve potentially the fascia or muscle, often those might present with fever, significant pain or induration, and they may require more wound exploration to confirm fascial integrity.
Deep SSIs may extend beneath intact skin, leading to abscess or fascial dehiscence if not promptly identified. Fascial involvement requires surgical exploration, debridement, and reclosure. Organ space SSIs such as pelvic or intra-abdominal abscesses may present later with fever, leukocytosis, and often require image-guided drainage. After drainage, the fascia appears intact and the granulation tissue begins forming. How would you manage the wound now?
For this patient with a superficial SSI, I would continue with the moist-to-dry dressing changes to support healing by secondary intention. Once the wound bed is clean and granulating, negative pressure wound therapy may be applied to promote closure and reduce fluid accumulation.
Negative pressure wound therapy, or NPWT, promotes angiogenesis and reduces exudate, edema, and bacterial burden. It can also accelerate secondary closure. Dressings should maintain a moist, warm environment and be changed daily or per NPWT protocol. Avoid occlusive dressings on contaminated wounds until the infection is resolved. All right, so let's say the patient's wound suddenly drains a very large amount of serosanguinous fluid on postoperative day 8, and you suspect a fascial dehiscence. How would you proceed?
I would take this very seriously, and I would cover the wound with sterile saline-soaked gauze, keep the patient NPO, and take her urgently to the operating room for wound exploration and potential fascial reclosure using a mass closure technique.
Fascial dehiscence is a surgical emergency with mortality rates up to 10%. It most commonly presents between days 7 to 10 with sudden serosanguinous drainage or a popping sensation. Immediate reoperation is required. the fascial closers should use a mass closure technique, incorporate all layers of the abdominal wall, except skin and fat, with delayed absorbable monofilament sutures such as PDS or Maxon. Bites should be 1 centimeter from the wound edge, spaced 1 centimeter apart, maintaining a 4-to-1 suture to wound length ratio. Interrupted sutures may be used if infection is present to allow drainage. Retention sutures are rarely used today, but can be considered in high tension or contaminated cases. So what would be the main risk factors that would predispose a patient to wound complications after an abdominal myomectomy?
When I think about risk factors for wound complications, I usually think about there are some patient factors and there are some surgical factors. For patient factors, I think about a patient's obesity, diabetes status, smoking, anemia, and poor nutrition. For surgical factors, I think about prolonged operative time, hematoma formation, tension at closure, or potentially inappropriate suture selection or technique.
Local factors such as ischemia, hematoma, or excessive cautery can impair healing. Systemic factors like malnutrition, diabetes, corticosteroid use, or smoking reduce collagen synthesis and wound tensile strength. Inappropriate closure techniques such as small bite size, inadequate depth, or excessive tension increase the risk of fascial necrosis and separation. Optimizing oxygenation, temperature, and glycemic control intraoperatively significantly lowers SSI rates. So what are some of the principles that you use to guide optimal fascial closure to hopefully prevent dehiscence in future cases?
When I'm thinking about closing the fascia, I think about doing a potential continuous mass closure for midline vertical incisions with a delayed absorbable monofilament suture, like PDS, as mentioned prior, taking 1 centimeter bites every 1 centimeter along the incision, maintaining that ratio of 4-to-1 of the suture length to the wound length ratio. I'd ensure proper tension without strangulation of the tissue and close the subcutaneous layer if fat depth exceeds 2 centimeters.
The mass closure techniques remain the gold standard for midline incisions. Delayed absorbable monofilament suture like PDS or Maxon provide durable tensile strength and resist infection better than braided sutures. Subcutaneous closure decreases dead space and wound tension in patients with thicker adipose layers. Overly tight sutures cause ischemia, while loose closures risk separation. Avoid non-absorbable sutures for primary closure due to sinus and infection risk. So what measures can be used to reduce surgical site infections in future abdominal procedures?
When I think about ways to reduce surgical site infections in the future, I'd ensure preoperative antibiotic prophylaxis is given within 60 minutes prior to the incision. I would maintain normothermia. I would minimize electrocautery. I'd practice meticulous hemostasis and gentle tissue handling, as all of these can contribute to increased risk for SSI in the future. And then postoperatively, I'd encourage the patient to do early ambulation and ensure maintenance of good glycemic control.
Antibiotic prophylaxis, which is typically cefazolin 2 grams IV or 3 grams if the patient is greater than 120 kilograms, reduces SSI risk by over 50%. Maintaining normothermia and oxygenation improves perfusion and immune response. Glycemic control and smoking cessation lower infection risk. Alcohol-based chlorhexidine is the preferred skin prep. Gentle tissue handling and minimizing electrocautery reduce tissue necrosis and improve healing. All right, so let's say in this case your patient is obese and has a BMI of 38. How would this affect your management?
When I think about this particular patient, I know that obesity increases the risk of wound infection and potential dehiscence of that fascial layer. I would be vigilant for seroma formation for these patients, and if there was a wound complication, I would be thinking about allowing that wound to heal with secondary intention.
Obesity reduces tissue oxygenation and impairs wound perfusion. Adequate subcutaneous closure and minimizing dead space are critical. Early ambulation also helps prevent venous stasis and improves healing. So let's say a seroma forms postoperatively. How would you manage it?
If a seroma forms for this patient, I would think about several things. So if there is a small asymptomatic seroma, I could just observe this and I do not have to intervene. If there is a large or symptomatic seroma, I may aspirate under sterile conditions and apply compression to the area. If I have recurrent seromas, I may need to require, opening the incision, potentially thinking about a drain placement or a capsule excision.
Seromas often develop from dead space or poor hemostasis. Most resolve spontaneously. Repeated aspiration increases infection risk, so conservative management is preferred. Preventative strategies include eliminating dead space, proper subcutaneous closure, and avoiding routine drains unless high risk. What if this patient was elderly or malnourished and they were undergoing abdominal surgery? What special considerations would you give this population?
In the preoperative space, I would really emphasize preoperative nutritional optimization. And then in the postoperative phase, I would really emphasize early feeding. I would have a heightened sense of monitoring of the wound for these particular patients. I'd also use non-opioid multimodal pain management and early mobilization to enhance their recovery.
Hypoalbuminemia and frailty markedly increase SSI and dehiscence risk. Adequate protein intake supports collagen deposition. Early feeding within 24 hours and physical mobilization enhance healing. Multimodal analgesia reduces opioid use and improves participation in recovery activities. What other preventative measures would you apply in future myomectomy cases?
In my future myomectomy cases, I would consider the following: a continuous strict sterile technique throughout the surgery, perioperative antibiotic use, maintenance of normothermia throughout the surgery, ensuring tight glucose control. While I am operating, I want to ensure meticulous hemostasis. Again, I would use that proper fascial closure technique and the appropriate suture material. I would avoid excess electrosurgery. And if that subcutaneous space was greater than 2 centimeters, I would ensure subcutaneous closure. In particular, think about my patient risk factors, including potential patients with higher BMI.
Adhering to CDC and ACOG SSI bundles such as chlorhexidine prep, normothermia, oxygenation greater than 80% FiO2, perioperative glucose control less than 180 milligrams per deciliter, and prophylactic antibiotics within 60 minutes of incision all reduce SSI by greater than 30%. Using monofilament delayed absorbable fascial closure with proper tension is the single most effective step against dehiscence.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Knife Premium Oral Board Review. Dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org. Download our free app available for Apple iOS and Android. Simply search for Behind the Knife in the App Store or Google Play to download the app. In the app, you can listen to our episodes, watch high-yield videos, and even access our premium content, including our oral board reviews and trauma video atlas. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and on Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening. We appreciate your support.
Until next time, dominate the day.